The death toll from the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza is nearing 31,000, more than 5 months into the war in the Palestinian territory. Several Palestinians have lost their lives after being hit by aid packages airdropped by the United States. And the Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it has targeted an Israeli intelligence base in the occupied Golan Heights. Thank you for joining us. Now, more than 5 months into Israel's genocidal war on Gaza, and the regime's indiscriminate attacks keep claiming more civilian lives. The latest strikes have hit different locations from northern Gaza to its central and southern parts. 8 people, mostly children, were killed in the southern city of Khan Yunis. Over 12 people lost their lives in Israeli attacks on 2 houses in the town of Al-Karara, northeast of Khan Yunis. Dozens more were wounded as a result. A refugee camp in Jabalia, the cities of Deir al-Balah and Rafah, as well as Gaza City, were also targeted. The total death toll is now nearing 30,880. Also, over 72,400 have been injured in the war taking place with U.S. complicity. Now let's take a listen to comments by some Palestinian parents and medics explaining how malnutrition is affecting children in Gaza.
There is no proper food for the mothers, especially in the recent period, as we noticed that since December until today, there are no babies with normal weights. Most of them are from 2 kilograms to 2.5. We stopped seeing babies weighing 3 kilograms as in the recent period. The last 4 months since October until today, there is no nutrition for mothers. There is no meat, milk, eggs, fruits or vegetables.
I'm a mom who lost her son due to malnutrition, due to circumstances we're going through in Gaza. You can see for yourself where we live, in a school inside a 3-meter tent right in front of toilets. What are you expecting from a sick child living in such conditions? How can he get better?
Yazan al-Kafarna, who passed away, was displaced from the north, and he originally had issues with his muscles, but his health was acceptable. He used to receive proper treatment and healthy food, but with the lack of food after the war began, he got worse.
Starvation in the besieged Gaza Strip continues to take the lives of vulnerable Palestinians. 3 more children have lost their lives as Israel blocks 8 trucks trying to enter the coastal territory. Gaza's health ministry says the children died from lack of water and malnutrition. Starvation has taken 23 lives in Gaza over the recent days. Meanwhile, 5 Palestinians, including children, have been killed and several have been injured after being hit by aid airdropped by the U.S. The incident occurred when parachutes attached to 8 packages failed to open, causing the boxes to fall on crowds that gathered to collect them. Israel has blocked the entry of almost all essentials into the Gaza Strip, including foodstuff, medicine and water, since the regime began its onslaught on the territory in October. March the 8th marks the International Women's Day, an occasion women across the world celebrate and also use to push for their rights. But the situation is different in Gaza. There, women along with children make up most of the casualties caused by the Israeli war and face a worsening humanitarian situation. Let's take a listen to some of the comments by women in Gaza.
We face the horrors of bombings, endure harsh conditions in tents, and suffer from extreme weather. That leaves no room to celebrate.
Women worldwide eagerly await and celebrate this day, whereas Gazans live in tents and are deprived of rights and unable to celebrate it.
I'm a woman who lost an eye due to bombardment. We are constantly being relocated from one tent to another, moving from one region to the next.
We're displaced and we've experienced the loss of our homes and our children who were martyred. Our hope is to one day celebrate Women's Day in our hometown under ordinary circumstances.
In Beirut, women have gathered in front of the UN Women's Headquarters to slam the US-Israeli genocide and draw attention to the plight of their fellow Palestinians. Let's take a listen to what some of the demonstrators had to say.
We, Arab women, are not slaves. And if these colonial institutions won't do anything, let them leave. It's enough. We can't keep living a normal life with what is happening. No free person in the world, no free person in the United States, Europe, or Arab world can tolerate what is happening. Palestine is free and will stay free.
You know, today is International Women's Day and is a celebration for women taking their rights and not being marginalized. But we are here today to support Palestinian women as they are now living in war, violence and pain. We insist that we won't celebrate if Palestinian women do not take their rights. We are here to support Palestinian women who are exposed to war, to celebrate Women's Day and be happy that women are taking their rights and be more empowered. We should defend Palestinian women to be able to participate and celebrate International Women's Day with us.
We're protesting in front of the UN Women's Headquarters in Beirut because it's International Women's Day and we can celebrate today and talk about the advancement of women and investment in women around the world when there is a genocide happening in Gaza. When the women of Gaza are suffering from the worst and greatest forms of torture, physically, mentally, and health-wise. They are being subjected to exploitation, starvation, impoverishment, displacement, and genocide.
In France and around the world, women and men took to the streets to celebrate International Women's Day. Gender equality is defined differently in different countries, but most agree that all societies must improve their empowerment of women. Robin Mazari reports from Paris.
On the International Day for Women's Rights, demonstrations and pro-feminism strikes were held around France by women and the men who support their fight for equality. In October 1789, the Women's March on Versailles apprehended King Louis XVI at his luxurious palace and brought him to justice in Paris. But much work remains to be done in Republican France. Only 37% of French Parliament is female. Two-thirds of France's working poor are women, in large part because women compose 80% of France's part-time workers.
A return to far-right economic austerity after the COVID lockdowns hurt women more than any other minority. Women are more likely to work in the government and to use social services, so cuts to government budgets hurt them more than men.
In France, one woman is killed every 3 days by their partner or ex-partner. Our government must take more measures to protect the safety of our women. We also need policies which abolish the male-female pay gap and which better protect women from rape.
Israel's attempted genocide of Gaza has had a disastrous effect on women. From the starvation of 60,000 pregnant women to the forced displacement of 1 million females, to the inhuman and degrading treatment of women by Israeli forces, according to the United Nations, to the murder of nearly 10,000 women.
Israel's genocide in Gaza is an issue for all feminists and for all humanists. Anyone who thinks that we are at the wrong march are obviously just Zionist imperialists, and they also obviously do not understand what it means to support women with equality, respect, and justice.
Globally, 60% of poor people are women. They are paid 23% less than a man, even when doing the same work, and they spend 2.5 more hours doing domestic chores than men.
We have made some progress pushing women's rights to the forefront, but we must demand many other advancements. We must also not forget about the rights of girls, many of whom suffer from sexual violence, and who must be better protected and better represented by our government.
In France and much of the West, women suffer from widespread objectification and the commodification of their bodies. France allows the use of naked women in public advertising, which many say undermines its regular claim to be a feminist model which other nations must emulate. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Thousands of Yemenis have taken to the streets of Sana'a and other cities to reaffirm their continued support for the Palestinian people. The demonstrators also praised the recent operations of the Yemeni army against the US, UK and Israeli-linked vessels. The Latifa Washali reports from Sana'a.
Yemenis from all walks of life gathered in the capital Sana'a and other major cities and chanted slogans in praise of the Yemeni army's naval operations. They also reaffirmed their full support for the Palestinian people and pledged to continue the protests until the Israeli genocide ceases.
The Yemeni government, all its members, its president and the people have one position, which is to support the Palestinian cause. We must thwart the American, Israeli and British project and stop starvation in Palestine. Our position is an honorable position and our broad movement indicates that the Yemenis have great awareness and, God willing, victories for the nation will be at hand.
Protesters expressed support for the Yemeni army's naval operations against Western vessels, stating that the Palestinian cause helped the Yemeni people overcome the problems created by the Western powers in the country. They believe the conspiracy targets the whole region, not just Palestine or Yemen, and call on all Muslims to unite to thwart Western projects.
We went out today in Sana'a, as you can see, and in the rest of the governorates to announce to the world that our demonstrations and our position is a religious position that will not change with regimes or rulers. We will continue to insist on our position until our brothers in Gaza are victorious, receive food and medicine, and the US-Israeli genocide against them stops. Our army will also continue its operations until the aggression against our country stops. Our operations are escalating, and upcoming strikes will stun both friends and enemies.
Our demonstration here in Sana'a and other governorates is to send a message that we as Yemenis have been able to overcome all the differences and problems that the enemies sought to create inside Yemen. The other message is that we continue to support the Palestinian cause, and what is happening in Gaza is shameful for all Arabs and Muslims. The operations of our army in the Red Sea and Bab al-Mandab are completely linked to what is happening to the people of Gaza, and the escalation of naval military operations is a legitimate move to support the Palestinian cause.
Recently, the Yemeni army intensified its naval attacks against American, British and Israeli-linked vessels in regional waterways, resulting in the sinking of a British vessel in the Gulf of Aden. It also attacked an American vessel, which the U.S. claimed led to loss of lives among the ship's crew members.
Yemenis assert that the success of Yemeni naval attacks, despite the presence of Western warships in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, demonstrates the capability and height of weaponry possessed by the Yemeni army. They believe this achievement should inspire other regional forces to join the fight and support the Palestinians in face of the common enemies. Abdul Latif Roshali, Sana'a.
Welcome back. No let-up in Israeli atrocities in the occupied West Bank as the regime pushes ahead with its genocide in the Gaza Strip. A Palestinian has now died after being injured and abducted by Israeli troops in Jenin. Our correspondent, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier from Ramallah for more on this latest Israeli crime. Let's take a listen.
This time, the Israeli forces committed yet another crime. The Palestinians in Jenin. The Israeli forces stormed Silat al-Harithiyya town, West Jenin, and surrounded a home of Palestinian Muhammad Adel al-Shalabi from Silat al-Harithiyya. He's a former prisoner, and the Israelis claim that he was wanted by the Israelis, and he's a member of the Ad movement. For 7 hours, the Israeli troops surrounded the home, and exchange of fire have taken place between the Palestinians and the Israeli forces. But unfortunately, Muhammad Shalabi was shot and wounded, and the Israelis had detained him with two more Palestinians. After several hours, the Israeli military informed the Palestinians, and the Palestinian Commission of Prisoners Affairs said that Muhammad Shalabi succumbed to his injuries, as the Israelis informed him that he was shot, wounded, and then he succumbed to his injuries, and thus we are declaring a new martyr. The number of Palestinians who had been killed by the Israeli forces since the 7th of October today is 425 Palestinians here in the occupied West Bank. The majority, of course, were shot and killed during military raids to Palestinian areas at the military checkpoints.
Israel says seven of its soldiers have been wounded in a Palestinian retaliatory operation in northern occupied West Bank. Gunmen first opened fire on Israeli troops near the settlement of Homesh. They then detonated an explosive device when the regime's troops pursued them. The Israeli military described the incident as serious and has launched a manhunt for those who carried out the operation. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has hailed the operation as heroic and a natural response to the Israeli massacres in Gaza and the West Bank and its violations against the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds. It vowed that, quote, painful blows to the heart of the Israeli entity and settlers will increase in the month of Ramadan. The Islamic resistance in Iraq says it has carried out a fresh attack against Israel in support of the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip. The resistance group says it has targeted the regime's intelligence base in the occupied Golan Heights. The group says it has used drones to attack the Israeli site. No further details are available about the attack. In recent months, the Islamic resistance in Iraq has carried out a series of attacks against Israel's positions in the occupied territories. It has also attacked U.S. military bases in Iraq and neighboring Syria in retaliation for Washington's support for the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Iran's foreign minister has denounced as illegal and unethical the decision by U.S. social media company Meta to suspend the Instagram accounts of the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution. In an interview with the Middle East Eye, Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the move is a violation of freedom of speech. Amir Abdullahian said Meta's actions are part of a wider campaign by American social media platforms to censor pro-Palestinian voices. Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has condemned Israel's genocide in the Gaza Strip and the U.S. support for the onslaught. Well, that's it for this hour's bulletin. Take care for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
As the U.S. ambassador to the UN recently made clear in a rare moment of honesty, Washington is fully committed to facilitating the Zionist regime's destruction of the Palestinians. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, there are times when it makes sense, for the sake of one's mental health, to simply ignore the boilerplate platitudes of politicians and official representatives, and other times when a strict attention must be paid. In the case of the U.S. regime, given the truly dismal level of its official discourse at this point, it has become harder to tell the difference. as the president himself is unsure of whether Ukraine, Iraq, Mexico, or Egypt might be in question on any given day or on those very rare days when he actually takes a question or two from a mostly stenographic and domesticated press corps, it has become easier and easier to just stop paying attention and simply write all of it off as subterfuge and nonsense meant to add yet another layer to the iron wall protecting the Zionist regime's genocidal actions. And yet, there are those rare moments when one official or another actually says what they mean and reveals how policies intend to proceed. Following discussion and the scathing response by the Russia's UN ambassador Vasily Nebenzia to last week's reprehensible and criminal US veto of the Algerian resolution for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, the US ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, offered a very brief press conference. In conclusion, she stressed the importance of direct diplomacy on the ground until we reach a final solution. The thrust of this, of course, is that there could be no immediate ceasefire since the delicacies of direct diplomacy might be disturbed. In other words, let the horrors continue, come what may, and let the rest of the world be damned, as the US regime and its few remaining allies buy more time for the child killer regime of Israel to achieve its purported goals. Through the fog of propaganda, disinformation, and all kinds of coercion, not to mention the huge UN veto stick wielded by the US regime, can there still be any doubt about what those goals actually are? As the overturned window of what has become normalized continues to expand exponentially on the ground in Gaza, it would be difficult not to understand the intent of Thomas Greenfield's phrase, final solution, and the whiplash sense of cognitive dissonance it was meant to inflict. The Gaza Weapons Testing, Population Control and Surveillance Lab, open to global consumers since at least 2007, and the Zionist regime's imposition of a total blockade on the Gaza Strip has clearly moved into a new phase. While there are instrumental political implications of great import in this new phase, there is as well a direct affront to our every sense of what it still might mean to be human in the digital age of immediate global communication. An almost full lockstep consolidation and docility of mainstream Western media sources. What are we to make of the US enabling of the relentless Zionist regime killing and destruction machine, along with the almost unfathomable daily cruelty accompanying it? Is it simply in order to kill and terrorize as many Palestinians as possible, particularly children and women? Is it to destroy all existing institutions and structures? Roads, water systems, power stations, agricultural capacities, homes, schools, universities, hospitals, libraries, mosques, churches, bookstores, bakeries, pharmacies, and even so-called designated safe zones to the point of making Gaza completely uninhabitable? Or is it in order to take over and exploit the offshore gas fields that Palestinians have a right to benefit from but have never been given access to? Might there also be other messages directed at the world? In the days immediately following Thomas Greenfield's delaying tactic of yet another US veto to a ceasefire solution and her final solution utterance, Israeli occupation forces built a road cutting northern Gaza off from the south, while bombing UNRWA facilities and a Doctors Without Borders staff shelter. Food and medicine supplies continue to be blocked and stalled by Zionist occupation forces, falling one of the first recorded cases of an infant dying from starvation. 10,000 more children are in imminent danger of starving from malnutrition. And after them, of course, many more children and elderly are likely to follow. Some 500,000 people are close to famine in northern Gaza, even as Israeli regime snipers strafe Palestinians desperately trying to reach the little aid that trickles in. With a precise level of genocidal cruelty that becomes ever more evident, the Zionist regime forces carried out precision strikes in Beit Lahia and Jabalia to destroy rescue and sanitation machinery and vehicles. This has increased the chance of disease spreading in those areas, while forcing residents to search through the rubble for survivors or the bodies and body parts of loved ones with only their hands and basic tools, even further exhausting the already malnourished. At the same time, Egypt, inexplicably not yet having torn up its peace agreement with the child killer regime of Israel, continues apace in building some vaguely referred to area in the Sinai Desert at the border with Rafah. Most recently, the Zionist regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu released his first sufficiently vague post-assault plan for control of Gaza. Meanwhile, many Zionists remain displaced. The economy has taken a serious hit, and other than pure destruction and death, things are not going so well on the ground regarding Netanyahu's purported aims of the assault, repatriating Israeli hostages and destroying the resistance movement Hamas. How, at this point, can anyone doubt that mass expulsion is not only possible but plausible? And as both occupation and settler raiders continue their deadly rampages throughout the West Bank and Al-Quds, can anyone still seriously doubt the possibility of the actual destruction of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, something constantly alluded to and even gleefully taught in some Zionist regime's schools? Clearly, the surround sound blather spouted by various political figures is one of the prime means to contain our imagination, to refer to things only within certain parameters, making other things unthinkable, unimaginable, even as they stare us directly in the face.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends. And here is an aphorism from Imam Jafar Sadiq, peace upon him, the Prophet's 16th infallible successor. If a person observes his brother in faith performing something evil and does not prevent him in spite of his ability and authority to do so, then he is really treacherous to his brother.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Islamic spirituality is necessary for everything. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, it's an honor to be here at your service. We are talking about Islamic lifestyle, and the program today we want to talk about something specifically, which is this idea that spiritual purification and spirituality is something which is necessary for everything. Now, when we're talking about Islamic lifestyle, of course, we very fully well understand that spirituality is something which is an integral part of Islamic lifestyle. Of course, if we want to talk about a physical body and a physical body that has a spirit within it, that spirit is spirituality, and Islam promotes and emphasizes both the physical and the spiritual aspects of not only a human being, but really the cosmos, in general. Now, spirituality is something, of course, which is incredibly important in all of these aspects, right? The spirituality and this, great moral and ethical virtues that bring about perfection for a human being. Well, that's really the core gist of everything, right? It's something that is incredibly necessary in our lifestyle, especially in our Islamic lifestyle. You know, without that spirituality, we'll just have this empty shell of a body and an empty shell of a life, and it really will not be satisfying at all. And that's something that we see across the world, that despite having the material means beyond imagination, because there is no spirituality, people are suffering on a global level. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about Islamic lifestyle and how spirituality is really integral to everything. We talked about how that, you know, you can have all of the material means and resources, at your disposal, all of them. And there are people and there are certain, you know, segments of societies across the world in which you see that the material aspects are completely taken care of. But despite that, because the spiritual aspects and spirituality is not being addressed within these human beings or within these societies or these segments of society, we find that people are suffering, people are sad, people are not happy overall. And that is because the spiritual needs are not being taken care of. And this is precisely where Islam comes into play. Islamic lifestyle, one of its fundamental aspects is spirituality and this connection with Allah and this connection with the afterlife and this connection with eternalness and eternal happiness and eternal life and these moral and virtues. All of these things are really truly bring happiness to a human being. Islam is the one who is promoting this and teaching this to a world which is devoid of all of these spiritual aspects as we move forwards in time. Science without spirituality is a danger. Knowledge without spirituality is danger. And of course, any kind of a lifestyle without spirituality is a danger. And so if we want to attain that Islamic lifestyle, one of the things that we're going to have to do is to pay attention to our spirituality and our spiritual selves. Thank you.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
To avert famine, there must be road access to Gaza's north. Words from the World Food Program. After apartheid Israel turns back a convoy trying to get food into Gaza. Hello everyone and welcome back to Gaza Under Attack. I'm Saeed Bourza. U.S.-Israeli bombs continue to rain down on Palestinians in Gaza as talks for a ceasefire grind on in Cairo, Egypt. Hamas has presented its proposal for a ceasefire agreement to mediators. The Israeli regime has not sent any negotiators to the talks. What will their response be? Lebanon's Hezbollah has launched heavy rocket barrages at an Israeli kibbutzim in the north of the 1948 occupied territories in response to an air raid that killed three civilians in southern Lebanon. The Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, have called for an immediate and durable humanitarian ceasefire in the besieged territory as the holy month of Ramadan approaches. And apartheid Israel's war cabinet minister Benny Gantz in London after spending 2 days meeting power brokers in Washington. Is this the beginning of the end for Benjamin Netanyahu? In only 5 months, the U.S. Europe-backed Israeli genocidal campaign in Gaza has killed more than 30,000 Palestinians and wounded over 72,000 others. With us on this edition of the program, British-Palestinian student and activist Tarek Othman, and Rick Sterling, a veteran journalist working with the L.A. Progressive, Anti-War, and Al Mayadeen, to name just a few. Rick joins us via Skype from the Bay Area in California, USA. Thank you both for being here. I'll start with you, Rick. Biden gave the impression a ceasefire was as good as done and dusted, yet here we are. What do you think are the stumbling blocks to a cessation of violence at the moment?
Well, the main stumbling block is the United States' refusal to demand that Israel stop its genocide. There have been three United Nations Security Council resolutions that the United States alone has vetoed. The latest manipulation and trick is for the U.S. to say that Hamas is responsible, but in truth, it's the U.S. and the Israeli government.
What do you make of the U.S. government's claim of putting pressure on Israel to agree to a truce, albeit temporary, and a captive swap?
Well, I think they definitely want a fig leaf, and Joe Biden and Joe Biden's team realize they're in big trouble because the majority of the population in the U.S. and even more so in the Democratic Party are supporting a ceasefire. So they're out on a limb, but they're so beholden to Zionist forces in the United States that they have to do this dance where they pretend to be calling and pushing for a ceasefire and abhorring the slaughter going on there. But at the same time, they want to give Israel more time to try to achieve their goal, which is not achievable.
Exactly. And of course, they continue to veto UN Security Council resolutions calling for an immediate ceasefire, not to mention the continuing flow of American weapons and money to Israel. Tarek, let me come to you for the next one. How does all of this make you feel? More than 5 months on, 152 days on 30,000, more than 30,000 people killed, more than 72,000 people wounded, and yet not an immediate permanent ceasefire.
I don't know, what words there are left to describe
the situation in Gaza right now, the situation in Palestine. Every combination of condemnation and visual imagery and visual description has been used. Every poet has used every last, you know, description they can think of. And I'm not going to better describe that. We, as all Palestinians, as all, you know, people who are seeing it, you know, see a genocide unfold with, you know, with their own eyes on camera, on Instagram, on social media, whilst our political class are 100% backing it, we've completely been lost for words. There's nothing that can describe it better than
what kind of action will you take? Because we're in an election year, not just here in the UK, but in the States and more than 50 other countries. When you see this dithering on the part of the political class here, as you put it, be it the conservatives or Labour, someone as young as you and the likes of you out there, how will you get back at these people in power who can stop a genocide but won't or haven't so far?
Well, very simply, I would refuse to vote for any of these supposed representative parties. Many people make the comment that if I was to not vote for Keir Starmer or Labour, that would make a conservative leadership more likely. Mm-hmm. The very simple fact is that if we're going to profess to be in a democracy, then I have every right to have a party that represents me. If we are in a professed democracy, why am I being forced in practically to vote for people who we all know don't represent me and have no intention of representing me and the vast majority of the British public, which, as I'm sure you understand, 67%, I believe.
66%.
Support an immediate ceasefire. And yet, like you were saying, there's a complete, you know, undemocratic and extremist attitude towards this that has justified, as we speak, the genocide of my people. And I'm not going to, you know, vote or put my support behind anyone that hasn't done everything in their power possible to stop that.
And the rise in the number of independent candidates and minor parties is probably going to put an end to that political duopoly in Westminster.
Well, I hope so.
That is the hope. Rick, we've passed 150 days, as I mentioned earlier, of this relentless bombardment. What is your assessment of where things stand?
Well, in 1967, the U.S. launched a surprise attack on its Arab neighbors, and in 6 days, they were able to decimate the air forces of those neighbors and win that war. In contrast, we've got 150 days or five full months of Israeli slaughter, massacre, and killing, and they are nowhere near achieving their goals. The Palestinian resistance has withstood this onslaught, this slaughter, and I think the Israeli government is desperate because they can see that their goal of winning a quick victory is not being achieved. They can see that the world is increasingly turning against them, even the West, so that the U.S. is you know, almost alone. They're not entirely alone. Germany and the U.K. and France are still supporting them, but less and less so. So the pressure is building, and Netanyahu is desperate, and in a way the U.S. is desperate to see this come to an end.
Sure is desperate. There's, of course, divisions inside the Israeli so-called war cabinet. We'll talk about that in a little later in the program. But meantime, the U.S., Qatar, and Egypt have been attempting to hammer out a ceasefire agreement, at least on the look of it, for a number of weeks with seemingly little progress, despite early optimism. Earlier this week, the Egyptian foreign minister Sameh Shoukry met his Dutch counterpart for talks where the fate of the negotiations was outlined. Rick, let me come to you for this one as well. The Israelis have not bothered to send any negotiators to these talks going on in Cairo. Does this tell you just how little regard they have for the whole process?
Well, it's an indicator, and it's going to be interesting to see what they report back to the International Court of Justice, because they're coming up on the deadline where they have to report. Meanwhile, their overlords in Washington are in deep trouble. Just as in British politics, we're seeing upheavals with George Galloway winning a landslide victory. 7 days ago, we had a Democratic Party primary race in Michigan, which is a very key state in the United States election process, and over 100,000 registered Democrats voted uncommitted. So this is a sign. Ideologically, Biden is a Zionist. He's dependent on Zionist funds, and yet most of the party is not feeling that way and is increasingly wondering what the heck is going on. So it's the same thing as your guest from Britain was saying, where this, you know, increasingly a contradiction between democracy and what we're seeing in reality.
Do those electoral developments in the States perhaps explain the Biden administration's eagerness to claim victory in some kind of a temporary truce?
I think they would be very happy to have that happen. But it's a bit of a smokescreen because they're talking about, just like you say, a temporary truce. And whereas other people are saying that we need to have a ceasefire that stops it once and for all.
Correct. And Tariq, Egypt, one of the parties to these ongoing negotiations, could they do more? And could the Arab bloc overall do more to bring an end to this?
I think there's a lot they can do to alleviate the suffering that Gazans are going through at the moment. The borders are still not as open as they should be. There's still not enough aid getting through. And I don't want to say that's the fault of Egypt in so much as it's the fault of the Egyptian leadership, which is an important distinction to make. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I think we can all agree that Egyptian leadership, just as much of the Arab leadership, is not at all representative of the population and the people in these countries. What we are definitely seeing is a very lackluster response. I think all of us Arab Palestinians are utterly disappointed in what has been, you know, little more than words and messages and a couple. Nothing more than sort of virtual signalling, sort of, technical achievements of airdropping some limited amounts of aid.
Yeah.
When we're talking about the mass starvation of 2 million people right at their border. So, of course, there's more they can do. There's more they could have done over the past, not just since 7th of October, but for the past 50 years or so, that they've sat idly, maybe not completely idly, but for the current regime has sat idly by as they've seen their brothers across the border under siege for decades now. And I can't say I'm surprised, but I'm definitely disappointed.
And yet some of them normalized ties apartheid Israel
Egypt,
too, didn't they?
Jordan have normalized ties with Israel.
UAE, yeah.
Yeah, and they've used that, of course, as an excuse.
All right. Thank you for that. That is all the time we have. My thanks to our guest, Tariq Uthman, here in the studio with me, and Rick Sterling. Until next time, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the Limelight.
Early on March 29th, starving Palestinians were queuing for long-awaited deliveries of food in Gaza City's Al-Rashid Street when the Zionist regime forces opened fire on them. According to Gaza health officials, a minimum of 112 people were killed and 280 injured, the majority of whom appear to have been shot. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, if hungry people in Ukraine had been shot and killed while queuing for food, the West would have rightly called it a war crime. Likewise, if troops opened fire in Syria, the US and the UK would rightly condemn it as an atrocity committed in this context. However, when people are queuing for food in Gaza, where the UN has warned of the worst famine it has ever recorded, the US instead noted it would complicate peace talks. Early on March 29th, starving Palestinians were queuing for long-awaited deliveries of food in Gaza City's Al-Rashid Street when the Zionist regime forces opened fire on them. According to Gaza health officials, a minimum of 112 people were killed and 280 injured, the majority of whom appear to have been shot. Fares Afana, head of the ambulance service at Gaza's Kamal Adwan Hospital, said medics found dozens or hundreds of bodies lying on the ground once they reached the scene. He said some wounded had to be carried to hospitals on donkey carts as there were not enough ambulances to take all the dead and wounded. There are counterclaims that only a small group were fired upon and the majority were killed in the crush from the resulting panic caused by the shooting. Either way, people would not have died if desperately hungry people had not been fired upon while queuing for food. This is a war crime and a crime against humanity. There is not one single document that sets out international humanitarian law, IHL, and international human rights law, IHRL, but a series of internationally recognized treaties, customs, conventions, and standards. In every iteration of these, it is made unequivocally clear that people in conflict must be allowed to receive aid, aid distributions must not be targeted by military action, and civilians must not be targeted by military action. The West cannot morally continue to shy away from highlighting violations of the rights of people impacted by conflict, whether it is in Gaza or anywhere else in the world that the Western regimes support them. Another violation of IHL and IHRL is when a military actor stops a population from receiving the basic rights, the food, causing widespread hunger and starvation. This is another accusation that has been made during the ongoing assault on Gaza, not least by the UN Special Rapporteur on the right to food. Is it not even more cruel and heartbreaking that people in Gaza, driven to record levels of hunger, so they queue en masse for any food, aid, so as not to die of starvation, are shot at and killed while queuing? As someone who for decades has been working in humanitarian emergencies and conflicts, while at the same time witnessing inhumanity at its worst, there are aid workers not sure they have seen a more horrendous atrocity committed in their lifetime. There is no way to look at the recent events without calling it what it is, a war crime and a crime against humanity. And the simple reason it is not being called what it is political. However, there is nothing political about the killing of innocent civilians. the U.S. Secretary of Defense, or we'd better call him the U.S. Secretary of War himself, has confirmed that over 25,000 women and children have been killed thus far in Palestine in just 5 months. On March 10th, many people around the globe will celebrate Mother's Day, yet in Gaza, so many children have lost their mothers, and so many mothers have lost their children due to this brutal conflict. Another milestone is the start of the holy month of Ramadan, a time when the majority of Gazans will fast, pray, and take part in spiritual reflection, self-improvement, and devotion. However, Benny Gantz, a Zionist war cabinet member, has warned that Rafah could face a ground incursion at the start of Ramadan, which the entire world, including the Zionist regime's partners in Washington and in Western countries, have warned against due to the likelihood of widespread civilian casualties. If this comes to pass, the horrors of the recent events will be repeated again and again. One of the most densely populated areas of the world will become a theater of war, which will mean more civilian death and life-destroying injuries. If firing upon starving people queuing for food goes unchallenged and unpunished by the international community, what incentive is there for military actors to spare civilian lives in a ground assault on Rafah? Why are governments around the world still supplying the arms to Israel to carry out these suspected atrocities instead of giving money to aid human life in Gaza? For those of governments observing Ramadan this year and those of countries who are not, we must support the people of Gaza all we can, and we must pray for an end to the atrocities committed by the Zionist regime against the people of Gaza. We must also pray that the Zionist regime, who has committed violations of international humanitarian and human rights law, will be brought to account. If they're not, what is to stop military actors from abusing civilian populations like this in all future conflicts across the world? These injustices need addressing, not just for the people of Gaza, but for all humanity. Midstream.
On Friday, March 1, Arab aircrafts conducted an airdrop of aid in the northern areas of the Gaza Strip for the first time. However, the hopes of that evening ended with men returning empty-handed. Contrary to the desires of families, yet at least they returned unharmed, unlike the hundreds gunned down by Zionist Israel while trying to get to the aid packages. The first planes appeared in the sky over Jabalia camp in the northern part of the strip and began dropping aid shipments over it. However, the winds did not favor the thousands of displaced people who raised their heads to the sky, anticipating the drop of relief materials among them, but it ended up landing actually on the beach. During the journey from the heart of Jabalia to the northern outskirts to obtain as much aid as possible, tens of thousands of locals marched on foot, covering a distance of over 3 kilometers. When the crowds arrived, the shipments had already been completely emptied, since thousands of residents of that area where the aid fell were waiting for it before it even touched the ground. Those who manage to obtain a bag of flour or a kilogram of dates or a bottle of water reached the outskirts of the camp with their hands and feet bruised from the intense competition and jostling to get even a little to alleviate their hunger and thirst. However, the airdropped food packages did not exceed the payload of half a truck. The information printed on those products indicates that they are sourced from charitable organizations closely associated